in Cork, and thank you to Paul for inviting me, and for being a powerhouse of such an amazing institution. I think there are cities all over the world that would be envious of what we have here. So long may it last. I'm going to read from The Heliotrope that Matches a Magnifying Glass, which was a collection that came out of a project that I was doing on translating a modernist avant-garde poet from Argentina called Alfonsina Storni. It's very well known in Argentina and Latin America, but not very well known in the English-speaking world. And her last collection, which was published posthumously, I decided I'd have a go at translating it because no one else had done it. And there's about six poems from here that are in there in that sort of traditional sense of a translation come adaptation. I carried on trying to translate these poems and then realised why no one else had done it. Because they were very difficult to handle, they were very hermetic, and they were quite difficult. So instead of trying to battle with that, I decided that I would respond and dialogue with her poems, a little bit like Joe Shacott did with Rilke's French poems, Tender Taxes, and Tom Paulin's done with Road to Inver, for example. So although we come from very different places, she came from Latin America, was a Buenos Aires poet, very urban, and I live in Bloomdale in the North Pennines in England, which is the least inhabited dale of England. I'm about 45 minutes from the Scottish border. And it looks a little bit like the Galtee Mountains. No trees, harsh and that kind of thing, windy, a bit subarctic. It's officially subarctic, so it could rain, it could snow next week, for example. So that's really sort of the background of it, and it's really an investigation of that land, which doesn't have a lot in it. So what I'm going to is just to give you an idea of what sort of the setting this place is. We have one road, that's it, that goes in to our dale, and it finishes and opens out into the Eden Valley, which is sort of where the English Lake District is. And there's lots of rabbits on flat rabbits on the road. It's one of those roads that motorcyclists really like. And we have a famous wind. I think it's the only named wind in the UK. It's called the Helm Wind, and it can blow. So this is called the B6276. Nothing's still. Even the dead are on the move. Trap sprung, wind snapped. The hills shake sun from lambs' backs and forth the flip side of kestrels. Don't be fooled by this road's thin drawl, its skin-smooth rhetoric, dreaming the perfect destination. Here, there are hidden dips. Observe the hash of roadkill casting off its camber of flies, flexed. Follow its logical conclusion, past lintels of sycamore, shake holes, slippings of peat, past the chapel of ease, the quarry, its mouth a vowel of scars, until you find yourself at sky's open doorway, where words like wait and hope are one and the same to the hollow tree shouldering the horizon. I'm involved in a sort of digitalisation of archives in this area, and we have loads. This is a lead mining area that the miners all left for the New World. A lot of went to the States, a lot of went to Latin America, and I've looked at a lot of these these letters that were sent back about their lives over there. And this is sort of an amalgamation of a few of those. And this is from, this is a miner that went actually to the Mexico-Texas border. And it's called Letter from a Mercury Prospector to His Wife in the Durham Dales, 1904. There's one word that you might not know, which is filibeg. It's the Northern English word for a kilt. And we have this helm wind as well that runs there. If you could see me in my bandana, my blue drill breeches, seams riveted against the jut of schist and tufa, my bracken skin, I fear you would not know the man you waved across the water some 6 months since. Today, we worked a new vein, the cinnabar ruddy below land that rounds like our own bald moors and fells that lies so bleached and ridged with heat, the ground has no given it, the vex and burns hold no moisture. For this, I've no need for vests nor filibegs, but thank you, and I retain the coat of good gabardine you made me, for the air blows as mean as any helm wind over Eden. And although the cloth has frayed, the stitches thinned, we pulled 50 flasks of ore this last month in, and I have hired a girl called Argentina, who darns, keeps house and cooks, and when the quicksilver works brisk off the smelter, sublimes the air, she steams blackbrush and mint to allay the fever, makes oatmeal mash for my loosened teeth as we sit and watch for clouds. She tells me then, when I am better, to send for you, and I say, of course I will, my love, of course I will. This really harsh environment. I mean, when Storm Alley came through, I live in a caravan, by the way. And have done for a bit. So it's pretty harsh on the on living up there. But I always find that the people are so mild mannered, even though they're up in pulling sheep and things like that out of drifts in the winter. And on a Monday, I go and knit and crochet and quilt with the women that live up there, and we sort of banter away. And I kind of get annoyed about how nice they all are. The wind's howling, and I'm just like, ugh. So this is my kind of call to arms to the nice women of Teesdale, which is this main area. This is called The Teesdale Furies Request Your Company. Come with us, women of the Dales, farmers, ironmongers, you the beloved Pilates instructors, let us braid your hair with snakes of wind, gild your breasts with the brass of hail, teach you to fold to a bat's wing and ride this muscled sky. Fly with us, women of the Dales, above the marts and care centres, the villages in bloom, the little Sainsbury's, let's raise a storm to beat all others, a mother of a storm, let's say, to stun the thunder from the mouths of gods, to suck the planets off their orbits. Feel how it is to roll these fells balled between your thighs, to stiffen lightning with your fingertips, whip whole forests to small voids. Then, skin spent like the slit of dawn rising, lie with us, slake desire in the fork of riverbeds, the shudder of peat, the flesh of constellations. Oh, that's nice. Okay, I said that this was a based on really the springboard for this was translating Alfonsina Storni, a state poet in Argentina. And so there are six poems in here that are sort of traditionally considered, at least up to an adaptation. And she had one poem which is called literally Return to Sanity. And in Spanish, it's Regreso a la Cordura. And there's sort of a play with the idea of cord, cordura. And so I called the poem Needlepoint. You picked up the sea as you left, shook the coral clatter of its hem, fishing boats fell from its petticoats. I caught them in the basket of my palm, felt your absence like a wicker tide in the upturned hulls. Now the sun's in pieces. Because of you, she's playing lighthouse, heliotrope with matches and magnifying glass. I sit at the edge of shadow, slip-stitch the horizon along its thread to white. When it's fixed in place and the waves unfold to meet it, I'll launch the fleet again, watch as they cast their nets, wait for the glint of fish. Was actually all sonnets that didn't rhyme. She called them anti-sonnets, and she's probably the first person in Latin America who had tried to do this. So she was quite clever. Although, I mean, I live on the spine of the Pennines, which is sort of the spine of the country, but I did used to live in a seaside town called Whitby, which is where Dracula was written. And it's a small town, and one of those towns that has sort of, you know, Kiss Me Quick cats and arcades and things like this. So this is called Siren Call, and this is the poem that won the Brit Call 2017. Siren Call. Shh. Listen. Not the gulls, their car alarm cries, or the waltzer's grease of screens, nor the crunch slide of the slot machines, the claw crane's snap of near misses, nor the busker's squeeze of his squeeze box, nor the brags of city lads and blow-ins buoyed on snakebite and black, tongues lashed like a riptide. No, not even the familiar sounds, your father unsheathing his knives to gut and fillet the week's catch, your mother's loud silence when his key isn't heard, circling the latch. No, there, amongst the clang of masts, strung from piling to cleat, yes, the rope, its twist and creak, its tug, tugging the moon's call to slip the knot from the small town that holds it to drift. Oh. We obviously, I'm right in the middle of the country. In fact, there is a place I can stand where I can just about see the West Coast and I can just about see the East Coast with a little bit of imagination. But we do have a river, the Lune. In fact, there are two Lune rivers in England, and ours is the small one. Because in the 60s, they made it into three reservoirs. They basically dammed it. And the water now, in around 45 minutes from the Scottish border, the water now goes to London. Mm. Which is a hell of a way to go. By this, the head of the river Lune is the Pennine Way, which is a walking route across the UK, and lots of walkers go there in the summer. And we also have the farmers employ mole men. Mostly men, not women, to catch moles, and when they catch them, they, I don't know if they do it here, they peg them on the fence to prove that they've done the work. So every so often you'll find whole sort of fences just dead moles.
You don't have moles in ours.
We have no moles.
Oh, you don't have any moles? Well, you don't need a mole man then. Wow. I thought it was a snake.
No, it's a different snake. Different snake from moles.
We'll talk later. I just read, was it Alan Boswell that wrote Dart?
Yeah.
About the river? Okay, I just read that. So there is a little bit of influence in this. And this is called The River Loon Speaks. Yes, I am here. Hear me, everywhere. Pinned to the roots of twitch grass, sharp-flowered rush, torn till. In this high place I am seep hole, fern gasp, speaking anaerobic with my other selves, Connipop Beck, Gull Syke, Rennie Gill. What do we know? Bones in the mine shafts near Dirty Pool. They have passed between us and the plover's sonar call. The mole catcher knows this. Here he comes, out of the ore rakes, walking my veins, whistling up mist with his bucket and sticks, his tunnel traps. He thinks this is his patch, but I could have him, under, easy. Show him worm larder, show him small blind mammals, before I widen and stretch, before I fatten and slow to reservoir, to bright valley. But not now. Now we'll leave him, hooking his wage on the fence by the standing stones. Instead, let's watch these ramblers, far from the way, who unscrew their flasks, eat snacks, loosen their boots, delighting in the sounds of the babbling brook. As you all know, poetry is not quite the most lucrative industry that it should be. And because of that, I've had quite a few other jobs in my life. Builder, car sprayer, and I'm still a qualified tattoo removal technician.
Wow.
Which actually is quite lucrative. These days. But this is a poem really about that work. It's called Tattoo Abstraction. There are things you need to know, says the man in the white coat. How the retina has no pain receptors. How if the laser beam strikes your eye, it will poach the tissue and the pop you hear will be the sound of blindness. He adjusts the nose strap on what looked like space-age swimming goggles. Under no circumstances remove these during the process, he says, putting on a pair of his own. She nods, cheeks chipmunking under the tight fitting. He takes her upper arm and spreads the skin, making Cupid's bow appear drawn, the arrow flexed. The banner unfurls and love blurs at the edges. We'll work the outline first, he says, atomize the layers so small the ink can release with an exhaled breath. She shuts her eyes and steels herself against the crack of collimated light that scores like 100 tiny irons. They had laughed at the pain back then, sitting on pushback chairs in the end of Pier Parlour, candy floss and kiss me quicks floating past the window. They'd giggled at the cliche of it, bands proclaimed in indelible ink, matching and mirrored. That night, their fingers honeymooned across the etching of their commitment, and as they slept, love's arrow quivered. The words are deeper than I thought, the man says, wiping pinprick beads of blood from her skin. You need to know that traces of them might remain. her eyes squeezed shut as she asks him to try all the same. There are things you need to know, he'd said one day, gripping her arms until the bruises surfaced as halos. The man removes the goggles. She blinks fresh light on her arm. Cupid, bow, arrow, and love are ablated in a steam of blisters. She takes a mirror from her purse and breathes in the droplets of condensation, watches the tiny wings take flight. When you get a tattoo removed, you will either cough, you either pee out the ink that becomes very small, or you actually cough it out. So that's a piece of it. Well, it's been a, it really it's been a pretty hot summer in Bloomdale, which is amazing. So this is a poem called Heatwave, and reading the papers, there were some really weird things that were happening, like, I don't know, farmers were putting sun cream on pigs, and putting little hats on them, and things like that. And there was an old people's home where everyone died of Caesar salad. Was left out. So this is a poem about the hot weather in Loondale. Heatwave. At daybreak, bats fall from the sky. Farmers fit pigs with wide-brimmed hats. Caesar's salad wipes out what remains of the old brigade. We are not surprised. Silly season means a run on portable aircon, paddling pools, mosquito coils, the tarmac bubbles. So we learn to walk on the dark side of the street, shed skin, watch strap and hem like shrinking tide marks, and wonder what type of man wears Jesus sandals in this stone age. In the fire of noon, we look for signs in the calligraphy of flying ants, scan our homes for new vocabulary, shrink, swell, heave, and ask each other, was there always this much haze? At night, the small hours thicken with the strain of corn crakes and restlessness. We syncopate our pulses to the whir of blades, lie uncovered, believing only heat separates us. Our blood rises through wing straws, yet only air stiffens, catching in our chests like sudden seafront. We long the dew point. And when it breaks one thunderous dusk, we scrabble for all the things we forgot, the half-cracked skylight, the parasol, the hardback discarded beneath the swing seat, kisses inscribed on the flyleaf. We shelter a moment under the eaves, tracing the inked arc with our fingers, steam quilting our shoulders, while above us, shadows dart and barrel roll between drops of rain, and we are surprised we ever doubted its return, its release, as constant, as steady, as breathing. As well as living in Loondale, I actually do get a bit of a break, and I work in Spain quite a lot, at a writer's retreat there, which is great if you ever want to go have a bit of a break. And this is a poem written while I was there, and it's called Extinction. Every day I climb the swerve of the hill, past the neighbour who chased me moons ago with a filleting knife, past the Barbary fig where old bachelors bring their rifles on those spring nights they miss their mothers. Here, strays linger, so I pick a stone from the path, then up, up into the business of almonds, the odd olive, past the unkempt mule keeping time with the harvest of church bells, up, up to the fizz of the pylon that carries its burden from this valley to the next, sounding like an ocean, sounding like an ocean that every day reminds me of Stella's sea cow grazing on Bering Island, unaware its fat is as yellow as the best Dutch butter, its meat like sirloin. It masticates the shore, not in the least afraid of sailors, the harpoon. Clouds shoal, I hear the dogs below, feel the rocks weight in my palm. From this far up, the neighbour, salting his catch, is so small. I gather windfall, husk split, watch women herd children to school, know I am a fool. Okay, I was going to read this poem out, but because it has a turn in it, I reckon I better, you know, better read it out. It's a Swede, actually, it's kind of turn. It's called On Botticelli's Primavera, and I don't know if you remember what the Botticelli's Primavera looks like, but you've got orange mangrove, a sort of orange grove, you've got Venus in the middle, you've got Zephyrus, the wind of the east, who impregnates Chloris, who becomes the goddess of spring. You've got the three graces. You've got 500 species of plants in the picture. And Cupid is aiming his arrow down on the party. I had that pinned somewhere, and I sort of I just turned it upside down, and Cupid is obviously then aiming up. So that was kind of the way this poem got written. On Botticelli's Primavera. If we turn it on its head, look at poor Cupid, thrashing his bingo wings, arrow aimed not down from the deep-chi orange groves, but upward, out of rows of what look like boule d'or, a hardy French turnip. God bless a nation that has never heard of Swede. I bought a packet of the seeds once, not here, where spring still spins her fretwork of frost, but in a sunny Occitan amour, where the women's talk was of chanterelle and walnut harvests, the lack of water in the cisterns, the children, or little ones, they asked, smoothing the polyester of their housecoats. They took me then to a barren patch of ground, bent to its stones, scooping the belly of the earth sunward, breasts pendulous as peppers. We planted them by the moon, garlic and artichokes, by the planets, elecampane in Mercury, motherwort in Venus. They taught me all their secrets, pinching out the seventh leaf so the melon gives its sweetest juices, how every plant has a perfect companion. The garden swelled and those turnips, tops breaking the surface like golden fontanelles. Here, the gritter's amber flash turns dusk to night as I rootle through old coffee tins for what's left. Here are those seeds, now past their best. Outside, Zephyrus blows blue the March wind, pressing his hands round the land's thin waist, lifting it, the hills as ballast. Well, while we're on a plant flower theme, this is about daffodils. It's called Getaway. One morning in spring, I climbed inside a daffodil, set out my things, projects I'd never got round to. I bathed in the buttered brightness of it all, the frisk of the oscillating stem, petals like moth wing, the view. Granted, the bees were a little unaccommodating, the five-eye frown. Haven't you got some work to be doing? But they brought me honeydew, showed interest in the latest Dan Brown and the waistcoat I was knitting. At night, the problems began. I should have known, given the design, its trumpet shape, the perfect amplifier. The ants, I could hear them for miles, their talks of weddings and parades. The crickets revved their piston legs like boy races. Who knew the comets sound like men at last orders, that stars stutter like suburban lawnmowers, that moonlight cries like a newborn behind paper walls. I gathered my things half finished, stepped out. What? I shouted to the street lamps. What? Okay, this is sort of a prose poem, and cheery. It's called Postpartum. She'd mottled like a gull's egg in the carrying of her, left the bairn, newly birthed, howling in twitch grass by the river, returned to her wheel to draft wool skeins, skirts crusted brown, foot against the treadle fast and even. Her oldest surviving found it, batted the flies from the cord freshly cut, found his father splitting kindle behind the bakehouse, who took the bawling bantling in his great flat palms, where the babby calmed, took to suckling his knuckles still sweet with wood sap. He pressed his wife to take the infant, held her raw hands, once as small, smooth as corn silk in his, called her harvest moon, as he'd done all those years ago in the stubble of the 12-acre. But with each appeal, she plucked a sheaf of hair from her head and, taking up her spindle, twisted the shafts to a silver ply that coiled like steel around her. The child whined, beat the lattice of her father's ribs for love or hunger, so he fossicked a horse bridle to hold her, and that was how he worked, daughter hoyed across his back in the quarry, or the length of field walls until spring, when, driving his pony string from shoreline to pithead, he unhitched the girl, for the bridle was needed for the journey, left her at her mother's feet playing with the rovings that fell from her spinner, hoping her laughter might feather his wife's heart. When he returned, 100 gold sovereigns lighting his wallet, a wattled crib swinging from his side, he found the farm deserted, but tied from the spinning wheel a moire of thread which he followed past older groves and drying sheds to the banks of the river. There was his daughter at the water's edge, naked, cough kinked. He scooped her up, swaddled her as best he could, but nothing, not even his knuckle dipped in bee bread, stemmed the crime. Then he saw it, flapping, a shimmer of cloth caught in shingle on the bank. He unhooked it, so soft, delicate, a shell. Holding it to his cheek, he heard it sigh, something akin to the wind in hay. Felt its weft of eye and limb upon him as he wrapped the child within it and lay her cooing in the crib. This was how it was told, up and down the marts and washhouses. Okay, and I'm going to finish now. So there are three poems in here that come from doing the five-word challenge, the competition. And one of them is in that anthology. So I thought I would finish with that, because I failed so badly on tonight, so I feel like I should. And it's called Disciplining the Modern Satyr. And I can't remember what the five words were, I'm sure. But I know there was amethyst in there, and I know there was nose. Can you remember what the others were?
One? Yeah. Which amethyst, Dora, dose, and nose?
which amethyst
door.
Which no nose. Okay, you had it. Disciplining the modern satyr. Ignore the fawning, the castanets, the way he calls you little witch and lifts your skirts with the tip of his nose. Grab it. Take the head of a live trout, put it in his mouth, let him breathe the air engendered there. Or take a shrew mouse, make a holocaust of it, serve it up as a curative dose. Don't let him talk you out of it. Don't confuse the soft suede of his chest with the sound of Jenny Wren's building nests. Do what your mother did. Your grandmother's. Take him to a tanner's yard. Hold him over the pit while the hides are turning. Tie an amethyst around his neck to dull the gleam in his eyes. If all else fails, lock the door. Make sure he swallows the key.
Woo!